cut your wood so easy. I'm a woodcut man. I cut your wood. Cut your wood so easy, baby. You can't hear me squeal on more. Cut it.
Indeed, he is a tail dragger. That's T-Model Ford and his song Woodcutting Man from his album She Ain't None of Yourn. T-Model Ford right there. Plus, we heard from Victoria Spivey from a collection called The Bluesville Years, Volume 8, Rollover Miss Beethoven. It's a good collection of female blues artists from back in the day. That was Got the Blues So Bad from Victoria Spivey. Up next, we're going to hear from Lightnin' Hopkins, recorded 1973, the album called Double Blues. This is Too Many Drivers. Lightnin' Hopkins on the Deep Blues Hour.
Baby, you got too many drivers. Lord, when you ain't got but just one wheel. Baby, you got too many drivers. Oh, Lord, when you ain't got but just one wheel. Yeah, you know things look mighty funny when two men's. Oh, Lord, it's driving your little automobile. Yeah, you know I'd rather be rolling down off a sandy hill. Yeah, you know I'd rather be rolling down. I'd rather be rolling down a sandy hill. Then I know you got so many drivers, and you ain't got but one little wheel. Set and sell your little automobile. Yes, you ought to go ahead on, woman, and sell your little automobile. Yes, you know, out of all of them drivers you got, you lucky if you don't get someone killed.
Right now, we all might feel a little disconnected. For seniors living alone with smaller social circles, feelings of loneliness and isolation can feel overwhelming. But there's something we can all do to help. Connect with your older loved one virtually and have the conversation of a lifetime with StoryCorps Connect. Anyone can conduct an interview, and every interview will be archived at the Library of Congress, becoming part of American history. Connect, honor, share at StoryCorpsConnect.org/AARP. A message from AARP, StoryCorps, and the Ad Council.
Lord, be her resting place. Woman, I'm trouble. I be all wood mine. Well, baby, I can't never be satisfied, and I just can't keep on. Baby. See, not a doggone thing. Woman, I was trouble. I was all wood mine. Well, honey, I could never be satisfied, and I just couldn't keep up. Well, I know my little old babe, she gonna jump and shout. That old train be late, man, Lord, and I come walking out. I be trouble. I be all ruined by. honey, ain't no way to work for me to be satisfied. And I just can't keep on crying. Woke up this morning, found my baby gone. Woke up this morning, found my baby gone. I didn't have nobody, no one to talk to me. Such a blue Monday morning, woke up and found my baby gone. Such a blue Monday morning, woke up and found my baby gone. I didn't have nobody even down to talk to me. Please somebody try and help me find my baby soon. Cause I ain't got nobody keep me company.
A tune from one of the more prolific of blues recording artists. That was John Lee Hooker, and a song called Blue Monday on a 1963 record called Don't Turn Me From Your Door. Before John Lee Hooker, we heard from Muddy Waters, and that was his tune from 1948 called I Can't Be Satisfied, from Muddy Waters. Up next here on the Deep Blues Hour, we're going to hear from Lucille Hegeman. This is some fine pre-war blues recorded in 1925. This is called Every Time I Pick a Sweetie. That's right, Lucille Hegeman here on the Deep Blues Hour.
I know a girlie named Molly, the sweetest baby in town, nicknamed Hot Tamale by all the boys around. Among the up-to-date vampires, this baby's causing a stir. Those red-hot mamas and the other charmers have taken lessons from her. They called her Hot Tamale. Just another vamp in school. Hot Tamale Molly, she's a gal that can't keep cool. Is she hot? Tell you what, most everybody knows. When they kiss after this, he'll have to wear at best a cloth. Hot Tamale Molly, to camp one day. Was it hot? Tell you what, it made his gold teeth melt away. Hot tamale, Molly, just a diamond in the rough. Hasn't got much polish, but she shines when she's doing a job. Like a false word, was all I've been told. She does a three-letter word, and I don't mean cold. On a point, she's a toy, she's a hot tamale of mine.
Hello and speedy delivery. This is Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I'm in Pittsburgh. I always listen to WRCT right here in Pittsburgh. Speedy delivery to you.
I've been drinking all night long, baby. Mama, I ain't gonna drink no more. I've been drinking all night long, baby. Mama, I ain't gonna drink no more. I could get myself by drinking any more corn liquor. Oh, she don't want me no more. I'll pack your suitcase, mama. I'm gonna throw it over the fence. I'll pack your suitcase, baby. I'm gonna throw it over the fence. Oh, Lord, you don't need no telling, baby. Mama, cause she got plenty of sin. I told you to stay away my window, baby. Mama, don't knock at my own back door. I told you to stay away my window. Babe, don't knock at my own back door. Oh, Lord, you don't need no telling, mama. Babe, cause you already know. Thank you.
we go on old Southern rag. We out there in all that cotton fields. We them people plant all their rice, we sugar cane. And peas and so forth grew. Yeah, man, I want a match for me for lighting my pipe, yeah. Go on, old Geechee. I ain't studying about you. No, I know you had to study me now. When you get my rice, though, I bet you study me then. Bet you that. Let's meet me at the end of the road now. I show you how to pick this cotton. Either dig potato, either one. Strip more raw sugar cane than you strip in 10 years. Now we gonna do the dance now. They call the Geechee dance. I'm gonna give you some music you call the Geechee music now. Gal, get away from him, them. Cause I'm gonna grab him directly and gonna take him everywhere but loose. You better get that thing fixed just like this now, cause I'm gonna stop.
A fine tune there from Blind Blake, entitled The Southern Rag, from a Yazoo collection of his best of recordings there from Blind Blake. Plus we also heard from the Memphis Jug Band with an early recording of theirs called the Evergreen Money Blues from about the 1926 era, I think. That's off of a disc called State of Tennessee Blues that Memphis Archive Records put out there of the Memphis Jug Band. All right, let's hear now just a few last tracks for the to end up this hour of the Deep Blues Hour. Let's see, we've got Ike Cossey coming up, a little song called Ike's Blues, plus Chris Kane is going to wrap us up with My Mood. But first, we're going to hear from the one and only Leadbelly, otherwise known as Huddy Leadbetter. This is the Dallas and Fort Worth Blues from the Rounder disc called The Titanic. Leadbelly here on the Deep Blues Hour.
Give her my money, she gives to her brand new man. the cold but blue, it does hard to see. Got a full boy blue, the dad is hard to see. Can't help but thinking, do that woman love me? So glad, hon, that I can see. Baby, I'm so glad, hon, that I can see. Mama, you can't make no bad mouth out of me. But the only woman to be like J.J. Take two or three shooters and rob some fashion train. If you want me, woman, it's too like Jesse James. If you want me, woman, it's too like Jesse James. But to pack your suitcase and find your brand new man. And the poor boy blue, the dad is hard to see. The dad is hard to see. Can't keep that black woman hard from worrying me.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. She wasn't even really sure where she was at.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it. I felt so much better after my son told me, Mom, we'll figure it out.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Edition of Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Today, we're listening back to some of our favorite discussions with some of our youngest listeners. Kids do have a way of making you take a new look at words and phrases you've taken for granted your whole life.
Martha, do you remember that call we had from John, the fifth grader, who was curious about...
Oh my gosh, John. Oh gosh, how could I forget?
Hello, you have Away with Words.
Hi. I'm John, and I'm calling from Dallas, Texas.
Well, welcome to the show, John.
Hi, John. We're glad to talk with you. What's going on?
Well, first, I'm honored to talk to the Duchess of Dictionaries and the Sultan of Slang.
The what of slang?
The Sultan of Slang and the Duchess of Dictionaries.
Well, I'm happy to talk with the Wizard of Words on the line. What'd you call us for, Wizard?
I was watching TV and, well, they described a character as a loose cannon. I know it has something to do with a real smart trap, i.e. someone who's a little bit of a smart aleck, but that's all I can think of.
Oh, wow. Okay, so somebody was described as a loose cannon. And
yeah, they were a little bit of a hothead, mm-hmm. always making sarcastic remarks. Uh-huh. So that gave me a clue.
Yeah, what were you watching? What was happening on the show?
Well, an announcer was, like, describing a character, and this wasn't a live-action show. It was, like, an anime, and, well, they were just describing in a classic announcer character, mm-hmm. as they called them, with, like, describing being a character as they were stepping onto the stage.
Oh, I see. Okay. Gotcha.
Well, you know, if we tell you a little bit about the history of this expression, it might make more sense to you. Would you like to hear that?
Sure. That would be very handy.
Well, think back to those old wooden ships hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
You know, the ones with the tall sails.
Like, they might need to have cannons in case, like, pirates try to invade their ship. They can knock them out before the pirates get there.
Yes, sir. Some of those ships had cannons on board to fire at other ships or enemies. And in those days, John, the cannons were mounted on wheels so they could be moved back and forth on the deck while you were shooting them and then loading them and shooting them and loading them. And usually those cannons...
Yeah. So it's like constantly... So those cannons were constantly firing off, and I think that was used as like a metaphor for like a constantly firing off mouth. Because it was, you know, constantly firing everything out. You know,
that's a great guess.
Constantly firing out, like all those cannons on that ship.
Well, you're right that it's a metaphor. But, you know, usually when they weren't using the cannons, those cannons were securely fastened to the ship. But imagine if they came loose, if say, the ship got into a bad storm at sea and, you know, just riding the seas like a roller coaster, you don't want that cannon to become loose because if it does, you can imagine what would happen, right?
Kaboom, 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 you're sunk.
Pretty much. Even if the cannons aren't loaded, they could go rolling along and hurt somebody or slam into another part of the ship and damage it. And so you're absolutely right, John. It's a metaphor for somebody who's unpredictable or uncontrollable, just like a cannon rolling around on one of those ships when it's not supposed to.
You never know if it's going to accidentally fire, what it's going to crash into next, and who is going to get bumped into and knocked over.
Bingo.
Who's going to get knocked over. That's right.
Bingo.
So, yeah, don't be a loose cannon if you can help it.
Yeah, try not to.
John, you really do seem to have a way with words.
Absolutely.
I get that a lot. I just have a large vocabulary.
Sounds like I kind of always have. Yeah, sounds like it.
sounds like you
definitely are a word wizard. I really appreciate you calling us. And you know what? I invite you to call us again sometime, okay?
Plus, I have stereotypical word nerd glasses.
Oh, those are...
That kind of gives it away.
Yeah, me too.
It kind of gives it away.
Me too. Nerds unite.
So do I.
That's how we hide our secret identities. All right, take care of yourself, John. It was a real delight to talk to you.
See ya.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-ya.
Phew, Grant, I feel like I just got off a storm-tossed ship myself.
Absolutely. A little bit of a loose cannon there all the way around, I think.
Well, here's something else that'll make you do a double take when it comes to familiar words and phrases. When an adult shares a term that they misunderstood when they were a kid. Tracy Jo Kalla in Madison, Wisconsin, wrote us to say that when her mom was growing up in the 1960s, she always assumed there must be some city called Random, and that Random, wherever it was the home of all sweepstakes and contests. And that's, of course, because announcers were always talking about how the winners were going to be chosen at Random.
Random, Oklahoma, a great, well-known city. Yeah, random's a weird word. Originally in English, it referred to a great speed or force and motion, kind of a headlong rush, probably from an old French word that means to run faster, gallop, like on a horse.
Well, later we'll share some more questions from young listeners and more stories from adults about childhood misunderstandings.
We'll be back with more in a moment. But first, did you know that Away With Words is independently produced by a nonprofit organization and that the show receives no funding from National Public Radio, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the federal government, or any radio station?
That means that we depend on support from listeners like you.
So please, take a moment and hit pause and go to waywardradio.org. Click on the three pink hearts and chip in to help make new episodes. Thank you. You're listening to a special edition of Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Today, we're looking back at questions from kids. And one nice thing about hearing from our younger listeners is that they often ask about linguistic mysteries that you may have thought about once or twice, but then never got around to figuring out.
Hi, this is Katie Fuller. I'm calling from Texas.
Hi, Katie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Katie.
I was wondering, is it pronounced caramel or caramel?
You mean like the brown, sweet, sticky stuff that you might put on an apple?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what got you to wondering about that, Katie?
Okay, so my dad is from Nebraska, right? So he calls it caramel. So I call it caramel. But my mom calls it caramel. So I'm like, what?
Uh-huh. And where's your mom from?
My mom's from Texas.
Okay, so dad pronounces it with three syllables and she pronounces it with two?
Yes.
And you take your dad's pronunciation?
Yes, I do.
Why?
I'm not sure, actually. I kind of switch between them mostly, but, like, I usually say caramel. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why, honestly.
You know what? That's exactly what I do. I grew up in Kentucky, and I go back and forth between those two pronunciations. But get this, Katie. There are at least seven different ways to pronounce this word. Can you believe that?
Seven? What?
Yeah, so that first syllable alone, Martha, what is it? Three different ways to say that first syllable?
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about the word C-A-R-A-M-E-L, which looks like it has three syllables. But in the United States, some people say caramel, some people say caramel, some people say caramel, and some people actually say caramel. And that's just in the United States. There are three other pronunciations in England.
That's crazy.
The three-syllable pronunciation is one you hear mostly along the east coast of the U.S., all the way from Maine to Florida and into parts of Texas. But I'm not surprised that there's some difference because sort of the rest of the United States tends to pronounce it the other way.
Yeah.
There's no one place that pronounces it only one way. There's always a scattering of both pronunciations no matter wherever you go, no matter where you go.
Yeah.
I think I say caramel. My wife and I talked about this recently. I think I say caramel most of the time. And when you add it on to another word like caramel corn, I can't imagine saying caramel corn. It just doesn't sound right. Caramel corn sounds right.
Yeah, that's a good point. Do you eat caramel apples or caramel apples?
I eat caramel apples.
Yeah, yeah, me too. Me too.
But when I'm talking about other things, like caramel.
Right. Do you want a caramel? Sounds better than do you want a caramel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, this tastes like caramel. But your family is representative of the same differences that we hear all across the country. There are all these different ways to pronounce it, and there's no one correct way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you feel about that?
I think that's cool. I thought there were only three.
Yeah, that first syllable can be care, cur, or car. The last syllable can be male, mill, or mel. And that middle syllable can either be or not pronounced. And so mix them up, and you got a lot of different pronunciations.
Yeah.
You know, Grant, I realize I'm still all over the map when it comes to the pronunciation of this word.
I don't know about the pronunciation, but I'm all over caramel when it's all over an apple.
And then it's all over your teeth.
All over my shirt, my fingers. Well, another youngster's question got us thinking about the long history of some abbreviations we use today.
Hi, my name is Vivian. I'm calling from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Welcome, Vivian. What can we do for you?
I had a question. Why is the abbreviation for the word number, which is spelled N-U-M-B-E-R, N-O, if the letter O isn't anywhere in the original word.
Oh, so you're thinking maybe it should be N-U instead of N-O as an abbreviation, huh?
Right? I mean, like, probably.
It's part of a set of abbreviations we have that are basically older than English, or at least modern English. It goes back to the Latin form of the word number. It's one form of it was numero, very much like in Spanish and Italian today, N-U-M-E-R-O. And Latin scribes abbreviated a lot of their writing, and the way that they abbreviated that word was N-O, with a little mark, or maybe the raised O with a line above it to indicate that the word had been shortened. And so that's it. And so we've just kept that Latin abbreviation through the millennia.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. And there's a few others like that. Pound is a classic example of that, like the weight LB for pound.
Yeah. Yeah. And the original Latin word is numerus, but that particular case, the ablative case, means in or with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't really have cases in English in that way, so it's kind of lost on us, but yeah.
Well, cool. Thank you for telling me.
Yeah. That's pretty much it. Thanks for calling. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Vivian raised a great question. We take those abbreviations for granted, but then you start thinking, but wait, why do we abbreviate number as N-O or pound as L-B? But once you know the linguistic roots of those abbreviations, the answer is perfectly clear. The history is right there.
You know, come to think of it, another example is the abbreviation for the English word ounce. Ounce comes from the Latin uncia, U-N-C-I-A, which is a unit of measurement. And this ended up in medieval Italian as onza. And that word onza was abbreviated as O-Z, and we borrowed that into English as our abbreviation for ounce, O-Z.
That makes a lot of sense. I can just see the Italian traders not only giving goods to English speakers, but also language.
Right, all that Italian wine.
We'll be back with more calls for you in a moment. But first, help us keep bringing you more episodes with a gift to the nonprofit that produces this show.
Go to waywardradio.org, click on those three pink hearts, and give what you can. You're listening to a special edition of Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett. Today, we're celebrating the things we learn from kids and their curiosity about language. Many times, kids often have a perfectly logical guess about the origin of a word or phrase, even if it's not the right one.
Hi, I'm Harry Evans from Charlotte, Vermont.
Hi, Harry.
Hi. So the other day, I was cleaning my room, and my dad said, I want it as clean as a whistle. I thought about that phrase a little bit. I was like, wouldn't a whistle be sort of like gross almost from like people blowing into it, and like all the spit building up in it?
Yeah, like the spit from a trombone, right?
Yeah. So I was just curious about the origin of it.
Uh-huh. So Harry, you're in Charlotte, Vermont, which we talked about on the show, and we know it's pronounced that way. And you're how old?
I'm 14.
So that puts you in high school?
Eighth grade,
I almost.
Graduate tomorrow.
Well, congratulations.
Hey,
that's
congrats.
A big deal.
Thank you.
And do you keep your room as clean as a whistle?
No. Not at all.
What do you get from dad if you do make it clean as a whistle?
Probably video games.
Okay, that's not bad. And but so you're like, this is gross. It's covered in spit. Why would I want my room like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent question. Harry, the answer is that the kind of whistle that we're talking about in this phrase isn't the kind of physical whistle that you might buy in a store, like a slide whistle or the kind of whistle that your PE teacher might wear around his neck. It's the sound of the whistle itself. You know, when you whistle and it's just so clear and pure?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess it sort of makes sense.
Yeah, it's that kind of whistle. And the clean is a little bit different, too. It's not so much the idea of something that's not dirty, but you know how sometimes you use the word clean to mean completely, like cut clean through a piece of wood or something like that?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit different sense for both of those words. But clean as a whistle is just as pure as the whistle of a bird.
So the sharp sound that you make rather than the little thing that you blow into.
Yeah, and when it first shows up in the 19th century in English, it's used interchangeably with clear as a whistle. Sometimes you say clear as a whistle rather than clean as a whistle.
Cool, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, right? We think so, too. Harry, thanks for your call. We really appreciate it. Congratulations on finishing eighth grade.
Thank you.
All right, take care now.
Bye.
Bye, Harry.
Perfectly reasonable to wonder why we'd say clean as a whistle when a whistle is going to collect some spit and gunk, right?
Perfectly reasonable. Here's Here's another childhood memory along those same lines. Tommy Carberry lives in Lexington, Kentucky. He emailed us to say that when he was a kid, his dad took him on a sightseeing trip to Washington, D.C. And they had this map, and right in the middle was a section that said National Mall. And Tommy writes, "At this point in my tweens, in the late 80s, early 90s, I was obsessed with shopping malls, as most of us were at that point. The idea of getting to see the National Mall was just so thrilling." So Tommy insisted that they go early so they'd have enough time to see everything. "My dad was thoroughly confused," he writes. His dad said, we'll go by it and even walk around it, but there's really not that much to see there. It's more about the monuments nearby." And Tommy says, "Clearly my dad had no idea of the amount of time I would need to see all the stores at the National Mall. It must have everything, even a Banana Republic."
I can just imagine him waiting to see the, you know, the naughty T-shirts at the Spencer's Gifts on the National Mall. You know, the ones making fun of the president or whatever. Yeah.
Saving up his money, setting some aside.
Right. You know, looking cool for the attractive hotties that are walking by at the National Mall.
Right, probably bringing an extra suitcase just to haul all that stuff
home. Oh. There's lots more to come, but first, there's nothing we'd like better than to fill your podcast feed with lots more episodes of Away With Words. To do that, we need your help.
Go to waywardradio.org, click on the three pink hearts, and give what you can to help us keep bringing you shows that offer new ideas and fresh perspectives about language. You're listening to a special edition of Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett. Today, we're remembering some of our favorite conversations with some of our youngest listeners and with their parents.
Yeah, we often hear from parents and kids who listen to the show together. Maybe the family's listening in the car while they're out running errands.
Or maybe they're discussing words on the way to or from school. That can lead to some very revealing conversations.
Hello, my name is Matt.
And Simon. We're from Waukesha, Wisconsin.
Simon and Matt, hello. Welcome to the show. What can we do for you?
Well, we had a question. We were walking to school. This is actually a couple years ago, and we've been waiting to call. We finally did it. So we were walking to school, and we had a question. Simon, do you remember what words we were wondering about?
The difference between barely and nearly.
I was trying to think about it for a minute because they seem similar. But then I used sort of my dad kind of approach, was like, well, if you pardon my bluntness, but if you nearly poop your pants, then you almost did, but you're in the clear. If you barely pooped your pants, it seemed like you just a little bit not good, better go change. So that was my dad approach at translating it and putting it in a very very clearly painted sort of setup for Simon. So we've kind of explored that because they're sort of subtle opposites. But Simon, you had one too, right? What was your thought on it?
Like if you nearly fell off a cliff, you barely hung on, and then if you barely fell off, you nearly hung on.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it's true. It's all about those circumstances, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you might almost think about it as a timeline where there's an event, and nearly is before the event, and barely is after the event, right?
Right. It seems like it gets... Because when we were trying to look at opposites, you couldn't say, like, I nearly died versus I barely died.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's a completeness. It seems to work only if there were, like, shades of something, in a sense. Timing-wise, it seems to fit that.
Yeah, so it's more about chronological. It's more about time than it is about them being opposites.
That's so interesting because I think of it in terms of space. I'm thinking visually. Like if I reach my finger out and I nearly tap you on the shoulder, I didn't really tap you on the shoulder. But if I barely tap you on the shoulder, I've crossed a line.
But it's the lightest of touches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, time and space are mm-hmm. the keys here, I think.
I love it that Dad immediately went to the bodily functions for the explanation. And the son's got the classy one. He's talking about cliffs and falling. Nice going, Simon. Way to be the adult, kid.
You know, Grant, putting aside the part about pooping in one's pants, Simon really did ask a nuanced question, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Bravely asked it, indeed. Well, we've been talking about how questions from kids often make us stop and think about why we say the things we do. And then there are those funny childhood misunderstandings we still remember.
Joshua Minton left us a voicemail, and he said, I couldn't have been older than 4 or 5 playing baseball with all the older neighborhood kids. They let me have a quote-unquote home run. So all the kids were yelling at me to go home, run home. My house happened to be across the street, so I thought they all wanted me to leave. I literally turned around and ran home instead of running the bases.
I think I've seen that in a movie.
Well, you know, I had something somewhat similar happen to me when I was probably in junior high and I was on the church basketball team and I had warmed the bench during the first half of a game and they put me in the second half and I had forgotten that they changed which goal you're supposed to go to at halftime. And so I stole the ball and I was so proud of myself. I was running and running and I heard people on the sidelines saying, go, go, go. And so I kept going to the basket. I made a layup. But of course, what they were saying was, no, no, no.
Oh, no.
Well, at least my team was. I guess the other team was saying, go,
you
go,
scored
go.
In the wrong basket. How long did it take to live that one down, I guess? I wonder.
I still haven't.
Nightmare fodder when you can't sleep.
And when I do sleep, I dream about
it. Yeah, when you do sleep.
You know, I could also identify with this story from Sam in Nichols, New York. He wrote to say that he was confused as a kid when he heard the song Home on the Range. You know, it has that line about where seldom is heard a discouraging word. And little Sam wondered why in the world being out on the range made that word seldom discouraging to cowboys, where seldom is heard a discouraging word. And I thought the same thing. I could not for the life of me figure out why that particular word, seldom, was such a bummer for cowboys.
That's wonderful. What an odd parsing of that sentence. But I get it, because it's an odd phrasing for a child. It's not,
it is.
It's poetic phrasing or literary phrasing.
And we'd love to hear some encouraging words from you. So if you like what you hear and you want to help us make more episodes in the coming year, please chip in what you can to support the nonprofit that produces this show.
Every gift makes a difference. Make yours right now. Go online to waywardradio.org. Click on the 3 pink hearts to donate. And thank you very much.
Is Black liberation possible in the United States? Not as the United States is currently configured. These are problems that we can't vote our way in or out of. These are not problems that are on the ballot. We don't get to vote on the massive redistribution of wealth and resources in this country. It really requires a different society where there's the democratic input of all of us about what our society should be and what it should look like. That can't happen in the way that this country exists now. To that extent, what I'm talking about is really a revolutionary transformation of the United States.
That's Kianga Yamata Taylor, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Kianga Yamata Taylor on Black liberation. The widespread protests in the wake of the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor marked a new chapter in the struggle for Black liberation. What would constitute Black liberation? Kianga Yamata Taylor says, it's about self-determination. Can we make decisions free of economic coercion? Can we make decisions that are truly free? That, to me, is what liberation would be. She continues, I know that it's not something that Black people can achieve alone. Black liberation is bound up with human liberation. On a purely mathematical basis, Black people drift between 13% and 14% of the population. We can't get free alone, so this is also about really trying to examine the connections between the subjugation of Black people and how that relates to a wider web of subjugation of other people, and that includes white people too. Our guest today is Kianga Yamata Taylor. She writes and speaks on black politics, social movements, and racial inequality. She's a professor of African American studies at Princeton. Her articles appear in The New Yorker, The Nation, The Guardian, and Jacobin. She's the author of Race for Profit, How We Get Free, and the award-winning From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Kianga Yamata Taylor was in Philadelphia in mid-July. The interviewer was Michelle Alexander, Ohio State University professor and author of the bestseller The New Jim Crow. She poses the first question.
One of the themes that's most striking in your book is that it's impossible to understand Black politics and activism in America today, particularly with respect to the Obama era, without understanding the nature of the class divide that exists within Black communities. You know, in mainstream discourse, particularly within the mainstream media, when class is discussed explicitly, it's usually in the context of explaining or defending the angry white men who voted for Trump or the challenges the Democratic Party has faced in trying to appeal to less educated working class whites. But a key insight in your book is that class divisions are driving race politics. We're driving those protests to a large degree. And you write that Black economic elites have a vested interest in the notion of colorblindness and the myth that the US is basically a meritocracy and the notion that the election of Barack Obama shows that we have overcome or are overcoming. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the role of class in Black politics and activism and how the gap between the rich and poor is even more pronounced among Blacks than whites and why that matters in thinking about protest and politics then and today.
Yeah, absolutely. And the events in Ferguson, I mean, there are many events that crystallize this, but when you think about Ferguson and the way that, for example, the Congressional Black Caucus mobilized itself to go to Ferguson, and their main objective was voter registration, right? That this is, we got to get people registered and we have to vote, and that's the most important thing. And, you know, people try to characterize the clash and the conflict between young activists who were on the street and, you know, they booed Jesse Jackson when he spoke. There was sort of, you know, deep hostilities between these young activists and Al Sharpton. And, you know, people try to convey that as a kind of generational split. And clearly there, you know, there was some of that where younger people are more willing to take risks in their protests. Older people who have suffered all sorts of political defeats may draw more conservative conclusions about what we need to do in order to advance this particular cause. But another feature of it was a kind of class division between those who had some problems with governance and some problems with the status quo, but for the most part had reconciled and found ways to make the status quo work for them. And then a majority of poor and working class Black people for whom the status quo was quite deadly. And Mike Brown was certainly a symbol of that. And then when you get to Baltimore, I think there is a much more hard and ingrained division that we see all over the country now, whether it is in Washington, D.C., Chicago, New Orleans. I mean, there are many places that have Black elected leaderships, that have Black mayors, for whom, beyond the issue of race, they really have very little in common with the majority Black population, of the majority of Black people who are in their cities. And so in a place like Baltimore,
WRCT, Pittsburgh.